This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's summer sun season, although you wouldn't know it in Philadelphia where I live because it's been cloudy and rainy nearly every day. That summer suntan that we used to think gave us a healthy glow, we now know is probably damaging our skin and maybe even leading us a step closer to skin cancer. But those sunscreens with the SPF numbers, do you know what those numbers mean? Here to help us understand the sun's effect on our skin and how to best protect ourselves without becoming shut-ins is dermatologist Dr. Daryl Riegel. He specializes in skin cancer, sun damage, and aging problems of the skin. He's former president of the American Academy of Dermatology and former director of the American Board of Dermatology. Dr. Riegel is also a clinical professor of dermatology at NYU Medical Center. Dr. Riegel, welcome to Fresh Air. So what does the SPF measure?
There are three kinds of ultraviolet radiation, A, B, and C. UVC is blocked by the ozone layers. We see very little of it on the Earth's surface, although we are seeing a little more with ozone depletion. That leaves us A and B. A is the kind of light you see at the black light or, you know, light at a disco or something. That's ultraviolet A. It's the nearest to violet. And B are the rays you really can't see, but they're more involved with burning of the skin. SPF just measures the amount of UVB that they're blocking, the UVB protection level of what it is. And it's really a ratio of the amount of time you could stay out in the sun with the sunscreen versus without the sunscreen and not be sunburned. So if, let's say if you had typical skin where you burned in 20 minutes, if you had an SPF 10 on, it would take you 10 times that or 200 minutes of exposure to burn. That's a very simplistic explanation, but that's the idea behind SPF.
So the SPF numbers seem to be getting higher and higher. So if you get into the real high numbers, like 100 or something, are you twice as protected as you are if you were using an SPF of 50?
Well, you know, that's one of those questions the debate goes back and forth on. It's almost a question, is the glass half full or half empty? Or in this case, is it 98% full or 2% empty? An SPF 50, in theory, if it's used correctly, and that's a whole other issue, would block 98% of the sun's UVB rays. So that means only 2% would get through. An SPF 100 would block 99% of the rays. So you could say, well, there's not a lot of difference between 98 and 99%, but the reason you could argue it the other way is it's twice as good, is that only 1% is getting through instead of 2%. So only half the rays are getting through. And that's really – it's a bit of semantics in a sense, but that's why as you get to the higher SPFs, the additional protection is not that much, but there are reasons to have higher SPFs.
Would you use a higher SPF? Do you think it matters?
Well, I personally do. I actually use either the 70 or the 85, and I'll give you my reasons why. When sunscreen is tested, it's tested in a way that's really not used in the real world. And it goes back to the 1970s when sunscreens first began to be tested, where they used 2 milligrams per square centimeter of body surface. That doesn't sound like a lot, but if no matter what you look like, if you were to put that on, everybody would look like Casper the Friendly Ghost or the Michelin Man or something. You'd be white as a sheet. So realistically, nobody uses sunscreen the way it's rated. And that's actually unfortunate. The FDA is looking at different ways to relabel sunscreen. One of the things they should look at is how they measure SPFs. But all that aside, if you underapply sunscreen, and it's most studies show that people only apply about 20 to 50% of the rated amount, you're getting a lot less coverage, a lot less protection, rather, than you would see with the actual SPF on the label. So the higher SPFs are much more forgiving. And that's really the argument for them. People are going to skimp and underapply anyway, but you're getting – maybe if you use a 75 or an 85 or 100, you're getting the protection of a 15 or a 30 even though you're underapplying.
So can you give us a sense of how much we're supposed to be putting on? Like how greasy should we really be?
Well, yeah, that's a great point. And typically to cover your whole body, if you were covering your whole body at the beach, you'd use 1 ounce. Now, 1 ounce is the amount of – I hate to use this analogy as a physician, but the amount of a shot glass. Everybody can relate to that size. Most people underapply sunscreen. And I always love the question. Typically, sunscreens come in 3 ounce tubes or bottles because you could take them on the – check in your carry-on bag in the airlines now, right, because they have to be 3 ounces or smaller.
Right.
So theoretically, one tube should last for 3 complete body applications, right? And I'll get patients who will come in and say, you know, I've had this tube of sunscreen I've been using for 3 years. Is it still good? Well, theoretically, if they were at the beach, it should have lasted for three applications. So clearly they're under applying. But that's typically how you go through this exercise.
So you're just like putting some on your nose or something. Like, how thick a layer should it be? I mean, well, you can't use the shot glass analogy there because you're not covering your whole body.
Typically for the face, that it's should be a heaping teaspoon or a flat tablespoon will cover your face. That's typically what you're looking for, face and neck, to do that. And you know, the trick what I do is you don't want to put it all on one side and then start rubbing the other side. It becomes very uneven. So I typically take the right amount and then I dab it around my face and my neck and then I rub it in. So I've sort of spread it a little more evenly. If you do that, you avoid the problem of having too much when you first put it on and it's too gloppy, and then too little on the areas you're finishing up with. And the sunscreens used to be called sunscreens and sunblocks, the two different things. Now they're called organic and inorganic for the screens and the blocks. The organic ones are the ones we talk about, typically the sunscreens that absorb the sun's radiation. And the inorganics, or the old sun blocks, were the ones that reflected, like zinc oxide or titanium dioxide. Those you can often see on the skin when they're there. But the sunscreens typically, if you rubbed in enough, you don't have to see them and they're working.
After you've applied your shot glass worth of sunscreen, how long will it last?
It starts to degrade at about an hour. Many of the sunscreens by 2 hours are pretty much gone, with the exception of some of the newer formulations that will last 4 hours or longer. 4 hours for a sunscreen is pretty good, because if you went out, let's say you were in daylight saving time in the summer, that would cover you from 11 o'clock till 3 o'clock, which would be most of the time when the rays are strongest, and you might get by with one application. But if you're in the water or you're sweating or you have clothes rubbing on you in the areas where you are or something that's mechanically taking off some of the sunscreen, you probably should reapply every 2 to 3 hours.
Okay, so the sunscreens protect you against the UVB rays, but there's the UVA rays. Are they damaging too, and are we getting any protection against them?
Well, we are. I mean, and that's really where a lot of the current controversy exists. As I mentioned, SPF on the sunscreen bottle currently just measures UVB protection. And if we were talking 15 years ago, what we would have said is that UVB is much more important than UVA. And in fact, to get an SPF 15 or higher, you're putting enough sunscreening agents in the sunscreen such that you're getting some good UVA protection. But that all changed about a decade ago when a really nice study was done in Canada looking at 6 SPF 30 or higher sunscreens and measuring their UVA protection. And it turned out their UVA protection was all over the map. So it made us really rethink how we measure UVA protection. And in parallel to this, we started learning that UVA was more than, we talked about it in the past to be the aging rays, the things that cause the aging in their skin, and they do, but they also lead to skin cancer. So the real issue now is you have no way easily of knowing the best sunscreen for UVA protection. And that's what's before the FDA right now. And believe it or not, they have been working on this since 1978, 31 years going back and forth. And we're hoping finally that they will come to some closure on this in the next couple of months.
So meanwhile, when you're putting on sunscreen and it says waterproof, it makes you think, well, you could go swimming and you don't need to reapply it. Do you need to reapply it?
You do. It's interesting. The whole term of waterproof on the new FDA proposals will be removed, and they'll be able to call things water-resistant and very water-resistant as opposed to what they call things now water-resistant and waterproof. That's a whole other story, but it goes back to the 1970s when they were first testing sunscreens, and they were tested in a lab actually in Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania, and in that lab they had a 40-minute timer. So what they did is they put sunscreen on people. They put them in the pool for one cycle of 40 minutes, and they came out and tested them. And if the sunscreen still worked after 40 minutes in the pool, it was called water resistant. And if it went through a second cycle, another 40 minutes or 80 minutes total, it was called waterproof. So the FDA adopted these things. And for, again, the bizarre reason of why 80 minutes, it just happened to be twice the 40-minute timer. And that's actually still used when they do the tests on sunscreens. But since there's no sunscreen that's truly waterproof, the terminology will be water resistant and very water resistant to do that. What's interesting, in the last several years, the sunscreen manufacturers have come up with formulations that are much more resistant to breaking down. I mean, the way sunscreens work is, they, as I said, they absorb the ultraviolet radiation. Actually, what they actually do is they turn the ultraviolet radiation into a very soft red light, which you can't see in the daytime because it's too bright. But it converts the UV to red, which is harmless, and that's how it offloads the energy. But after a while, the sunscreen will break down from doing that. The newer sunscreen formulations do last longer than 2 hours. And we've done studies which show that pretty much every 2 hours you have to reapply. But with some of the formulations, they do last 4 hours or longer and still give you good protection.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Daryl Riegel, and he's a dermatologist who specializes in skin damage caused by sun and in skin cancer and aging problems of the skin. And he's a clinical professor of dermatology at NYU, past president of the American Academy of Dermatology. Now, I'm from the generation where a lot of people used, when they were young, sun reflectors, which is basically a piece of cardboard with something that looks like tinfoil on it to reflect the rays of the sun onto your face so that you get a quicker, more intense sunburn or more hopefully suntan. How much did those of us who use these things damage ourselves?
Well, pretty big time. You know, it's
thank you.
make you feel really good, right?
Yeah.
You know, the idea behind that was you just got extra rays hitting you. So think if you had direct rays and you multiplied it by two or three because you get the extra reflectance ones, you're going to get more intense ultraviolet radiation. I mean, these were basically the precursors to the tanning beds, if you think about it, because tanning beds have UV intensity of 10 to 15 times that of normal sunlight. You obviously tan faster in a tanning bed. That's why people go there, but you also get your damage faster.
So are you seeing a lot of patients who use sun reflectors and now have various forms of skin damage or skin cancers?
Absolutely. And typically what you see is you get the person who said, well, I protected the rest of my body, but I wanted my face to have color. So I used a reflector or I used a sun lamp or I used it years ago, whatever the things. And now they're in their 50s or 60s or whatever, because those were big in the 1950s and 1960s. And you see the extreme damage they have on the face. And they've had precancers. Well, they have aging. They have precancers and they often have skin cancers.
A lot of people are getting diagnosed with basal cell carcinomas and being told that they don't really have to worry a lot about it if it's diagnosed soon and it's superficial. Would you explain what they are and how much we need to worry about them?
Sure. There are three basic kinds of skin cancer, and they have to do with which is the cell that turns cancerous. The most frequent kind that we see is basal cell carcinoma, and that's the basal cell. It's the lowest cell in the epidermis, and it becomes cancerous from ultraviolet exposure. There will be over 1 million newly diagnosed cases of basal cell carcinoma this year in the United States alone. So it's the most common cancer. And in fact, it's almost as much as the sum of all other cancers combined. So it's very common. About 1 in 6 Americans or so will get a basal cell sometime during their lifetime. They grow very slowly. They rarely, very rarely metastasize. Usually it'll be if somebody has other problems with their immune system, such as if they're immunosuppressed for transplants. If you do catch them early, not a big deal. Even though they don't metastasize, though, they can become locally destructive. And 1/3 of all basal cells appear on the nose. So you can imagine it starts to eat away at your nose. You have some issues in terms of your appearance, as well as potentially it could get into deeper structures, get infected. So you can't let them go. You've got to treat them. But once you treat them, they're pretty much treated. There are a variety of ways to do that. Once you've had one basal cell, your chance of getting a second basal cell sometime in your lifetime is about 50-50.
In the same place or in another place?
Well, anywhere on the body. Because you've proven you have the sensitivity to grow them, and you've proven you've been successful at growing them. And it's probably from the same sun you got 10 or 20 or 30 years or so before. It's just they're like dandelions. They'll pop out in different spots. So not the first one spreading, but another one popping up.
So how do you recognize that you have one and therefore go to see the doctor about it?
The way you look for it on the skin in terms of basal cells, it's typically a spot that's just not healing. I mean, the story would be I had a spot. It was, I remember, 1/3 of them on the nose. So a typical story was it was on my nose. I thought it was a pimple, but it never quite healed up. It crusted a little bit. It bled, but it semi-healed, and it came back. And again, they grow very slowly. So often it's several months before somebody comes to me for having these diagnosed. But that's, I guess, your typical story. So if something is growing, bleeding, crusting, or changing on your skin, see your dermatologist.
And the same kind of thing on your ear, or don't you get a lot on your ear?
You can, and it's sort of interesting. Men get skin cancers on the ear about 6 times more frequently than women, and that's primarily due to hairstyles, right?
Oh, sure.
And that's universal across all countries that you see that. On the ear, often what you'll get is a squamous cell carcinoma, which, again, that's the squamous cell, the intermediate kind that turns cancerous. There are about 250,000 cases of squamous cell carcinoma each year in the United States. Again, if you see a red, rough, scaly spot on your ear, which you also could see on the face at other times too, or the backs of the hands are a typical site for a squamous cell, that's typically what you'd see and obviously have it looked at. The squamous cell carcinoma, again, is typically, as is with the basal cell, with people who have had chronic sun exposure. So they're people who spend a lot of time outdoors, haven't protected themselves. It's not from one sunburn, but it's a lot of outdoor exposure for those two types of skin cancer.
And with melanoma, the most deadly of them, if it's not caught early, is melanoma also caused by the sun, among other things?
Well, absolutely. The vast majority of melanomas can be traced back to sun exposure. The difference with melanoma, it appears it's not the chronic sun exposure as much as the sunburn that does you in. And you can look at a whole bunch of studies of melanoma that in terms of intense ultraviolet radiation does you in, sunburns, blistering sunburns, all those things increase your risk. The more of those you've had over life, the greater your risk. Tanning beds where the UV intensity is so much greater than it is in normal sunlight. And melanoma is really, it's again a cancer of the melanocytes, the pigment cells. So in most melanomas, you see a brown or a brownish black or almost a black spot that's growing early on. And typically in early melanoma, what you see is a brown spot that's got several different shades of brown. Instead of being nice and round or oval, it almost looks like it has little pods sticking out, like a spider almost or something, or a little lobster or something. The easiest way to recognize early melanoma is A, B, C, D, E. A is asymmetry. Early melanoma typically is not symmetric because one part of it starts to grow a little different than the other part of it, so you get that asymmetry. B is border. On normal moles, typically they have a very clear-cut border. You can see where the mole stops and the skin starts. With early melanoma, that border is either ragged, irregular, or indistinct. C is color. Most run-of-the-mill moles, they can be light, they can be dark, but they're pretty uniform in color, while melanoma will have multiple shades of brown or some blacks, even some blues sometimes. And then D is the diameter of being 6 millimeters or 1/4 inch or the size of a pencil eraser. So if you have the asymmetry, irregular border, and uneven color and diameter greater than a pencil eraser, and now we've added E to that evolving, so it's changing on top of that, those are suspicious signs to see your dermatologist and get the early melanoma removed.
And if you get it removed early, you're probably in the clear?
Basically, yeah. You know, melanoma, the variable that best measures how you're going to do is how thick the melanoma is. In other words, how far it goes down vertically. A melanoma that's only gone down 1 millimeter or less, that's a 25th of an inch, basically 95%+ of the people who have that will survive and do well. A melanoma that's gone down 3 millimeters or 1/8 inch, that's not much difference between a 25th of an inch, the survival is only 50-50. And if you go down to 4 millimeters, which is roughly 1/6 inch, then the survival drops down to about 30%. So those couple of millimeters difference is the difference between life and death in melanoma, and that's why it has to be detected early. A melanoma the size of a dime on your skin, which is not that big, has a 50% chance of having already spread. And once melanoma spreads, basically nothing works. So that's why it's such a lethal cancer that it spreads rather early in its course.
Is it worse for your skin to sunburn it when you're a child than it is when you're an adult?
Well, it's always bad to sunburn your skin. Let's start with that premise first. And by the fact your skin burns is a sign you've had ultraviolet exposure and it's damaged you. And actually, there's data to show that people have even one sunburn. If you can, they do some studies where they'll take people's rear ends that don't normally see the sun, and they'll give them ultraviolet radiation exposure for just one light sunburn. And you can see DNA damage and genetic damage in the skin for 4 to 5 days just from one exposure in a place that's never been exposed. So, you know, that is a major issue associated with. But there are papers that were written 20 years ago that suggested the sunburns you had prior to the age of 18 were worse than the sunburns you had afterwards in terms of risk. But it turns out that's not true. There have been several studies come out in the last 3 or 4 years that show basically whenever you get the sunburn, it's harmful to you in terms of subsequent skin cancer risk.
Has the sun gotten more dangerous because of the depleting ozone layer?
Well, that's another controversial point. I'm one of those who believe that it has. Again, if you look at the data on melanoma rates in areas where there's clearly been some ozone depletion. So, for example, in the southern part of Chile, which is an area that normally you wouldn't expect to have too much skin cancer, but over the last 15 years, as they map each year the ozone hole, they get their ozone hole in early spring, which for them is October. You see sort of a peak each year going higher and higher and higher for skin cancer rates. And certainly in southern Australia and Tasmania and that area in southern New Zealand, in fact, you do see some rates higher than you'd expect and increases more rapidly than you see it elsewhere in the world. So I think that is contributing, but it's really not the only factor and probably not the major factor, certainly in the U.S. at this point.
What is?
Well, when you look at the data in the U.S., I think the one measurable factor is the use of tanning beds. And what's interesting is if you look at the data for both men and for women by age and compare, though, the data from the late 1980s to the late 1990s, almost all the increase in melanoma in men and in women were people 45 and older. And again, it was expressing the damage that they did 10 or 20 or 30 years earlier. But the young people, the rates were pretty steady in. You're still seeing that same trend in young men, but in women, you're starting to see a marked increase in women with melanoma in their 20s, 30s, and into the early 40s, which you don't see in men. And the one factor that is different between men and women, young women, is the use of tanning beds. You know, the tanning industry is very large. There are about a quarter of a million tanning beds in the United States. At least the tanning industry's own data is that about a million Americans go to a tanning bed every day. I mean, that's a phenomenal number when you think about it. But that has to add up over time. And the tanning industry really started in the U.S. It's been 20 years or so. Probably the first tanning bed in the U.S. was about 30 years ago. But really, it was in the 90s when it started to ramp up a little bit. So we're just beginning to see the results of the tanning exposure from tanning beds as, again, with that latency of 10 to 20 years, we're beginning to see the effects of it. But there are now studies coming out showing if you've used a tanning bed, your risk of melanoma is greater. Your average age that you get your melanoma is younger. The risk of getting a second melanoma is greater. You tend to get melanomas in areas where the sun might not normally shine but does shine when you're in a tanning bed. And I could go on and on with these studies. So there's clearly an association. I told the tanning beds actually tanning coffins. I think that's a better description for them. But the reality is that it's not a good thing to do. And it's very analogous to cigarette smoking in the sense that it always pays to stop.
Are fair-skinned people – well, I know that fair-skinned people are more prone to sunburn. But does that mean they're also more prone to skin cancers? And conversely, are dark-skinned white people and people of color less prone to skin cancers if they've been in the sun?
Well, that's a great question. It's a very important one for a number of reasons. First of all, in general, the fairer-skinned you are, the more easily you sunburn, the less easily you tan, the greater the risk of getting skin cancer. However, even the darkest skin individual is at risk. They just have a lower risk than the fair skin individual. Roughly the data on melanoma is that the risk of a Hispanic American getting melanoma is about 1/6 that of a Caucasian, and of an African American it's about 1/25 that of a Caucasian. But note that it's not zero. What is interesting in people of color is that they typically will get their melanomas in a little different distribution. So often they'll get them on the palms and soles and not get them as much in other areas. They can, but that's typically where you see them. And why this is interesting, the incidence or the risk of getting melanoma on the palms and soles is the same across all races, whether you're Oriental, Hispanic, African-American descent, or Caucasian, your risk is about the same for that. Of interest, though, is that certainly in a Caucasian, you're likely to get melanoma in other places. But if you just looked at melanoma of the palms and soles, the incidence is about the same across all races. And this has led scientists, especially Dr. Boris Bastian, who is a dermatologist researcher at the University of California in San Francisco, to hypothesize that there may be more than one kind of melanoma, and he has some genetic studies that he's doing to support that. So we may find that there's one kind of melanoma that's you see more often that's more sun-dependent, and there's another kind that may be due to more genetic predisposition. We're only scratching the surface of this research, but in fact, it's interesting, and it may play out quite positively in the future.
Now, you know, we've been talking about skin problems, including skin cancers that are caused by exposure to the sun. One of the things that you specialize in is the aging skin. So while we're on the subject of aging skin, what do you think of anti-wrinkle creams?
The reason your skin wrinkles is because the tissue that supports the skin, we call the connective tissues, weakens over time. And there are a bunch of things that can weaken it. Sun exposure is one. If you take the skin, and let's say I'm not advocating doing this, if you did a biopsy of the skin of a baby's rear end, somebody had never seen the sun, and you use special stains on that biopsy to see the what we call the elastin tissue or the fibrous tissue underneath the skin, the supporting tissue, it would look like almost like a deck of cards that you cut in half and half shuffled and half pushed together. So you'd have a whole bunch of interleaved parallel fibers that were perfectly lined up. If you took the same type of biopsy, let's say on a 50-year-old who had on their forearm that had a lot of sun over the years, it would look like a ball of spaghetti because all the fibers would be disoriented and pulling in the way. And that's really one of the reasons why your skin wrinkles, why it ages, why it loses its tone, all those things, what you see. So, you know, in a sense, that's probably the biggest issue you have. And these anti-wrinkle creams are at least allegedly designed to try to give you back some elasticity to your skin. It's very hard to do it. It's not even with you know, the vitamin A derivatives, retin A and the other retinoids, which are vitamin A-like substances, it helps a little bit. You know, if you have fine lines and wrinkles with the cream-wise, maybe you get a 5% improvement or a 10% improvement. It's not going to work for deep lines really at all. It might work for those little fine lines around your eyes and help a little bit for that. But once you've got the deep lines, no cream is really going to work very effectively.
Well, Dr. Riegel, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure to be here.
And have a good summer.
You too.
Thank you. Dr. Daryl Riegel is a clinical professor of dermatology at NYU Medical Center and former president of the American Academy of Dermatology. Donald Rumsfeld has pretty much kept out of the public eye since resigning as Secretary of State in 2006. A new biography examines his life and career in great detail. The book is called By His Own Rules, The Ambitions, Successes, and Ultimate Failures of Donald Rumsfeld. My guest is the author Bradley Graham. He's a former Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post and covered Rumsfeld during his tenure as Secretary of State. Graham says, the story of Donald Rumsfeld is an exceptional personal drama that has had profound consequences for the U.S. and the world. Bradley Graham, welcome to Fresh Air. If you were summarizing your book with one headline, what would the headline be?
I think it would have to play off this notion of Rumsfeld as a tragic figure, you know, somebody with a lot of potential who undid himself. And so I'd probably come up with a headline, something like Brilliance Undone by Arrogance. He had so much talent going into this job. He was so well prepared for it. He's the only one who ever had been given a second chance at being Secretary of Defense. You know, he was Secretary under Gerald Ford, too, and at that point he was the youngest Secretary of Defense. Under Bush, he became the oldest Secretary. And for all his skill and knowledge, he ended up 6 years later very unpopular and ultimately compelled to step down from office.
It's hard to remember the days when a lot of people thought of him as like a stud, you know, a stud or an uncle, when he was really popular among some people during the early days of the war.
Oh, I know. The Afghan war and the 9/11 attacks really transformed Rumsfeld. It's hard to remember, but he, just before then, was really in political trouble. He had, in his first months as secretary, had alienated a lot of military brass, members of Congress, others in the Bush administration. There was a lot of speculation that Rumsfeld would become the first Bush cabinet casualty. But the Afghan war transformed him into a secretary of war and put Rumsfeld in the position of playing a leading role. He became the public face and voice of the U.S. military at war, and these press conferences that he gave allowed him to put on display his skills as a spokesman. You know, he's very quick-witted and blunt and knowledgeable, also amusing and entertaining. He came across as anything but the conventional bureaucrat, in the sense that, you know, he avoided euphemisms like collateral damage, but spoke about actually killing the enemy. He became so popular that with millions tuning in to watch his news conferences, that Bush nicknamed him Rumstud, and U.S. News and World Report dubbed his style Rum Punch. But there was more than just theatrics involved in his performances, because this surge in popularity that he enjoyed helped strengthen his own primacy within the Pentagon, in that he would often appear at the Pentagon podium with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dick Myers, and he overshadowed Myers considerably in these news conferences, seemingly relegating the role of chairman to one more of sort of a military assistant to the secretary.
Now, you write in your book that unlike some people in the Bush administration, Donald Rumsfeld didn't really believe in the principle of invading Iraq to spread democracy through the Middle East. He said at the time that he believed Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and we had to go in and take care of that. But knowing what we know now about how flimsy that evidence was, that there was actually weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, it's hard for me to believe that he really believed it at the time. I mean, again, considering how flimsy the evidence was, how much of it came from sources who were completely unreliable, who the CIA knew was unreliable. Do you feel like you have any further understanding, any deeper understanding of what Rumsfeld really believed at the time about WMD in Iraq?
I think he really did believe it. And it's one of the great paradoxes about him, particularly, even more than any of the other senior administration officials, because for years he had warned others about the need to avoid what he called a sort of poverty of expectations in sort of trying to gauge into the future and anticipate things that might happen. He was very fond of passing around an essay from a book on the Pearl Harbor attack that made just this point, that one should be very careful about falling into the traps of believing the conventional wisdom, the conventional intelligence, and always challenge and press for more. And Rumsfeld was known for asking lots of questions and for doubting and challenging. But strangely, he did not press on this point, or certainly didn't press enough on this issue of weapons of mass destruction, maybe because it just seemed so unrealistic that Saddam Hussein would not have them, given the way he was acting, and given how all the major intelligence groups in the world were asserting that he most likely did.
There were complaints within the Pentagon about Donald Rumsfeld's leadership. What were some of the things he did that upset the Pentagon leadership most? What were their biggest complaints?
Well, one was his seeming dismissiveness of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is comprised of the heads of the military services, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps. Rumsfeld came into office very determined to assert civilian control. He had the view that the military under the previous Clinton administration had gotten too much of what it wanted, and that civilians had not been able to exert the kind of decisive leadership that they should. And in subsequent months and years, the sense of that the chiefs had of being marginalized only increased. They felt left out of a lot of the war planning, and not really consulted in the way that they felt they should have been. But in addition to Rumsfeld's sort of short-circuiting of the Joint Chiefs, there was a lot of concern about his style in dealing with senior military. He often came across as abrasive, as impatient, as arrogant. He defends his manner, saying that the big leagues, as they were in, These senior officers with stars on their shoulder should have been able to take his questioning and his challenging, but they felt that it bordered really on the discourteous, and they really resented his manner in many of their contacts with him.
My guest is Bradley Graham. He's written a new biography of Donald Rumsfeld. It's called By His Own Rules, The Ambitions, Successes, and Ultimate Failures of Donald Rumsfeld. Graham is a former Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post, and he covered Rumsfeld when Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense. When Rumsfeld was arguing on behalf of invading Iraq and talking about how they had weapons of mass destruction and, you know, they couldn't get away with that, a photo started circulating all over of Rumsfeld shaking Saddam Hussein's hand. And this was during the Reagan administration when Rumsfeld was a special envoy to the Middle East. And he had paid a visit to Saddam Hussein, and Saddam Hussein had already gassed the Kurds. So we knew that he not only had the VMD, but they had used it. So there's a picture of him shaking hands. What kind of deal was he trying to make then with Saddam Hussein?
There was an interest at that point in 1983 in restoring ties with Iraq, and Saddam Hussein, on his part, was interested as well. I mean, relations had been put on ice by Saddam Hussein in the Iraq-Iran war. It's not clear how much Rumsfeld knew about Iraq's use of chemical weapons at that point, but he was under instruction certainly to facilitate a resumption of ties with Saddam Hussein, and very happy to do so.
And this had to do with oil?
Well, oil was a consideration, and they did discuss during Rumsfeld's meetings in Iraq the opening of the flow of oil and even construction of another pipeline. But basically, the Reagan administration was interested in the resumption of ties as a sort of counterbalance to Iran's influence in the region.
Did, in your interviews with Rumsfeld, did you get any inkling into whether he felt at all hypocritical about working with Saddam Hussein as an ally during the Iran-Iraq war, you know, going to Iraq, shaking his hand, trying to make a deal about a pipeline? After Saddam Hussein had already used gas against the Kurds, and, you know, flash forward to after 2001, and he's making the argument that, no, we have to invade Iraq because Saddam Hussein has WMD. Do you get a sense of whether he felt that there was any contradiction there?
Certainly the existence of the photos of that meeting were an embarrassment to Rumsfeld 20 years later when the U.S. was preparing to go to war. But I never got the impression that he regretted it. It was a case in his mind of the U.S. policy having changed over those two decades.
President Bush officially accepted Donald Rumsfeld's resignation right after Election Day in 2006. Bush had shortly before that asked for the resignation. Was Donald Rumsfeld surprised when he was asked for his resignation, and was he ready to resign?
From what I was able to learn in conversations with Rumsfeld himself, with his wife Joyce, and with others in the administration, he expected that he would have to leave, particularly if the elections resulted in a change of power in Congress. What he didn't anticipate was how swift the end would come. Bush seems to have made his decision several weeks before the election, or at least set up a very small group within the White House to plan the replacement for Rumsfeld. And they decided to have it take place on the day after the election. Rumsfeld was not a part of that planning. And so the end came very suddenly for him. He has not expressed any resentment about that, but his friends and family thought he deserved better. But in any case, he knew pretty much that he'd be leaving.
From your conversations with Donald Rumsfeld, did you get the impression that he had any doubts about how he handled the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan, for that matter.
He was very dismissive. He said, oh, that's, you know, that's a favorite press question, and he didn't really want to get into it. And I think part of that really is because he himself isn't sure. He hasn't worked through in his own mind what he thinks about some of these questions. He's writing his own memoir, which is due out in the fall of 2010, and he's struggling. He's really struggling. He's trying to remember a lot of things, and I don't think has resolved in his own mind really what to think.
Bradley Graham is the author of a new biography of Donald Rumsfeld called By His Own Rules. Oumu Sangare is a singer from Mali who's gone from an outsider who sang about taboo subjects like polygamy and forced marriage to a major national celebrity. Milo Miles has a review of her new album.
Seya is Oumu Sangare's first album in 6 years, and it's a landmark. It shows she's not just the finest female singer in Mali, but the African queen of soul. Seya is also the culmination of a musical evolution that was underway when Sangare first recorded in 1989. Like Amadou and Miriam's Welcome to Mali, also released this year, Seya represents a fully mature new type of African popular music. It is neither folkloric nor fusion. It neither caters to Western sound nor ignores them. It can only be created within today's global culture. Yet every moment of Seya reflects the joyful seriousness and serious joy of Oumu Sangare's personality. That's why she's the queen. As she always has, Sangare offers lyrics well worth reading. She addresses native social tensions either through frank admonition, girls shouldn't be sold into marriage before they have breasts, or sly animal fables, dogs shouldn't get mad at turtles because they can't bite the shell. No matter what mode she chooses, Sangare sounds a bit more polished, a bit more precise and at ease than ever before. The sessions feature guest players including African stars like drummer Tony Allen and guitarist Jelamadi Tonkara, as well as American horn veterans Fred Wesley and Pee Wee Ellis. But nobody takes over a tune. The Queen commands seamless integration. Like many African performers who establish an international career, Sangare has become almost a one-woman industry at home. She's involved in charities, car imports, running a hotel, and being a full-time fashion plate. The title song is all about spreading fun around, being sexy, and selecting fabric and clothing designers.
sete wara wara nino male wara wara le chanino amale chane sete uze uze nino male kamerenya wara wara tewa male nina wasugu bara.
Umu Sangare has earned the right to celebrate her stardom. Besides, she sounds humble in the face of good fortune and evokes community far more than ego. But where do you go from the top? What comes after the big time? Sangare is an unusually careful and deliberate creator. Seiya presents masterful music and a superb summation of her achievements. But Sangare's greatest challenge will be to find the next step.
Milo Miles reviewed Seiya by Umu Sangare. She begins a U.S. and Canadian tour July 2nd in Chicago. I'm Terry Gross.